What's up, everybody? This is Radio Free Nintendo, episode 166. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, Jonathan Lindemann.
Very pleased to be here.
Greg Lay.
Pleasure as always.
And very special guest, James Jones.
Very special.
Not a guest, but very special indeed. We're going to have a quicker show tonight. We're going to have new business, take a break, come back with your listener mail, and that's it, and it's going to be awesome. So, starting off new business is me this time, and I played a bit of Final Fantasy IV, The After Years, and I talked about this over the summer when it first came out, and, you know, I had downloaded, like, one of the side stories, like Rydia's chapter or whatever. I didn't play most of them. I did beat that one. And then I was just checking, I was wondering, like, did they ever put out the finale? You know, like the $8 second half of the main story? And a couple weeks ago, I was just flipping through it, and yeah, sure enough, it's there. Of course, I had to go back out to the Wii Shop channel to add more points because I didn't have enough.
We can't integrate these systems.
Exactly. It's just it's like, what is the point of having an in-game store if I can't buy points in-game? How is that really convenient?
What's the point of having points?
I mean, well, that's a legal thing. It allows them to sell cards in the store and shit like that. But anyway, I did buy that. It's called The Crystals. Super original. And I'm pretty early in on it. It seems that, I mean, it still plays like FF4 or whatever. I've still got a mysterious character in my party named Man in Black, who is clearly a character that you know from the original game. It's just not clear which one he is yet.
Johnny Cash.
And it might be obvious if I had played through all the other chapters. It might also be obvious why there's, like, holes in the ground and everything's fucked up and the world is... It's basically like the world of Ruin from Final Fantasy VI, except now in Final Fantasy IV. And I have no idea why it looks like that.
This is why RPGs have a defined starting point.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, I assumed that all of those chapters, all the side stories, were side stories that were optional.
Self-contained?
Yeah. And now I jump into the so-called second half of the game, and it turns out it's more like the final one-eighth of the game, I guess. I mean, in terms of length, I'm sure it's longer than all those side stories, but I'm missing a huge chunk of story here. I have no idea what happened
to this place.
Yeah. And it's weird because certain elements of it seem like they're picking up exactly where I left off. And yet there's all this other stuff that's gone down that makes no sense. And so I'm kind of pissed off about it, but, like, what do I do?
Could they go back and explain it later on? Could it just be part of the story arc in that chapter that
you're not meant
to know immediately why things are the way they are?
That would sort of mess with the Man in Black, but...
Yeah, there was the more to be revealed. Could also be Jerry Glanville, by the way.
That might be...
That's for John.
That might be pressing the creativity functionality of these people that I don't know they have.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, like, for instance, the party that I started with in this final chapter includes Rydia and Luca, who are characters that I played through in Rydia's chapter. Now, if I hadn't have downloaded that chapter, I have no idea why they were hanging out or what they were doing there. And then they've got these other characters in the party, Edge and the Man in Black, who I don't know how they met up. I mean, I played Rydia's chapter to the end. She had not run into Edge or the Man in Black by the end of that chapter. So, like, there's some other shit in another chapter that happened after that. I wouldn't even know what sequence to play these in. I mean, there must be a correct order, but they're not numbered or anything. I guess you'd have to go in the order they were released, except sometimes they release two or three at a time. It's completely insane. It's just disorganized as hell, and I'm a little pissed off because I do actually care about the story. I mean, it's a freaking RPG. It's one of my favorite RPGs.
It's kind of the point. Really.
Yeah. And now I'm just left like, I don't know, I feel like I jumped into Kill Bill Volume 2 without having seen the first one, you know? And it's like, well, it's cool, but I don't know what's going on. So, yeah, remains to be seen how I end up feeling about that. The other thing that I've been playing quite a bit of is Secret of Monkey Island. And this is the remake of the classic point-and-click adventure game. It's out on PC at least, and I'm playing it on Xbox 360 Live Arcade. But there is a PC version, and this is different, I should be clear, because there's also the Tales of Monkey Island episodic thing that's still in the process of coming out every month.
Yes.
And that's on WiiWare and PC. So that's kind of a new sequel. Secret of Monkey Island is the remake of the original PC game from, like, the late 80s or whatever. So Have you played this game before, James?
Yes.
Are you a fan?
From what I remember.
Yeah.
I played this back when I was not very old.
Just a wee right. little James.
Yes. I was knee high. But yeah.
Like the soda.
I enjoyed these games, but I enjoyed all these LucasArts point and click games kind of blend together in my head.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see why they would.
Because I was five mostly, but.
Well, I mean, and they're all very similar, other than the characters, yes. basically. And a lot of the characters are very similar anyway, because they tend to be very snarky. And, you know, back then they didn't have voice acting. The graphics were really low grade.
Oh, yeah.
The writing, I mean, even though they're all these different characters, they're all being written by the same person. And they're trying to be very humorous and sarcastic. And a lot of them sort of blend together after
a while.
They're
usually kind of weak characters, physically weak.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting that Tim Schafer is now doing Brutal Legend with this gigantic roadie
steroid
main
user.
Character.
Yes.
Yeah, because he, that's... That's unusual for a guy like him to do a character like that. Anyway, this is my first time playing Monkey Island, the original Monkey. I've never played any Monkey Island games, and I like it. It's very, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we talked about this when we did the adventure podcast, the adventure game episode. But when I grew up, most of the adventure games I played were like King's Quest. And in King's Quest, there's a lot of trial and error. If you use the wrong item on the wrong person, then you might die and have to like restart from your last save point or something. And in Monkey Island, as far as I can tell, there's no way to die, which does kind of free you up to experiment more. And it makes the game feel a little more whimsical and forgiving. But the puzzles are definitely tricky. Some of them really sort of stretch your sense of logic. Of what should and should not be possible, you know. Yeah. But in a lot of ways, honestly, the puzzle design is very much like those Sierra games. Yeah, you pick up a lot of inventory items, and you click all over the screen and make the guy walk around, and you use items and you solve puzzles, and it's all about pirates. It's cute. I like it.
Basically, it's this weak dude who wants to be a pirate.
Right.
And he's given these tasks to prove he's worth being a pirate.
Yeah, and right. A lot of those games were like that at the time. I think of a lot of those characters from Space Quest, King's Quest, they were always kind of the bumbling sort of...
Well-intentioned.
Not so much bumbling, but they're... I mean, James is right, they're physically weak, and the idea is that, you know, they're sort of your avatar, mm-hmm. and they were designed to appeal to nerdy kids in the 80s who knew how to use computers, which was unusual at the time. And, you know, the idea is that your character prevails not on physical strength, but on intellect. They're thinking games.
Before
you know?
We get corrections, Secret of Monkey Island came out in 1990. But
oh, okay.
It was the fifth game using the Scum system, so technically most of them came out in the 80s.
Yeah, Scum was Zach McCracken and Maniac Mansion and all that stuff, right?
Right. And I think there was even an Indiana Jones game
there
I
was,
when
yes.
it came out. But anyway, I mean, the cool thing about the remake on Xbox and PC is that they redid all the graphics. They took the voice actors... I think the first one in the series that had voice was like the third or fourth.
Probably.
Years later, mid-90s kind of stuff. And they took all of those people in the cast and went back and recorded the lines of dialogue from the original game, which had never been voiced before. So that's kind of cool. I mean, it makes it feel more like a modern production. And the acting is pretty good. The writing is pretty funny. Occasionally very funny, but usually just kind of chuckle stuff. But one of the really cool things is, at least on Xbox, you can hit the back button at any time, and the screen will shrink down into a square from the widescreen. You know, it'll go down to more of a square, and it'll show the original graphics as they were on the PC in the original version. And you can play the entire game that way if you want
nice.
To. I don't want to. But what I do occasionally is, like, if there's a close-up character portrait or something, I'll flip back to the old because I kind of want to see how they compare. It's pretty cool that you can do that. And you can. It's very quick, smooth transition. It doesn't pause the game or anything. You can do it as much as you want. That's a really neat little thing as far as remakes go. Yeah, that's Secret of Monkey Island. I rented Saints Row 2, which is kind of an HD clone of GTA San Andreas. It's neat that it's a lot more whimsical, and it doesn't take itself seriously like GTA 4, but it's not the kind of game I feel like playing right now. I picked it up several times and never played it for very long. It's okay.
It's like massively over the top, isn't it?
It's goofy. I mean, they try to, from the very beginning, they try to throw you into missions where you're doing some pretty wild stuff. So there's none of, like, drive this guy around town. You know, there's none of the sort of realistic build your way to the top kind of thing like you get in GTA. From the very beginning, it's like, go set all this stuff on fire. Or set yourself on fire and ride your ATV all over town and blow up as much stuff as you can for a so-called documentary. Yeah.
It's not a good career plan, by the way, kids.
It's crazier than GTA, but it plays exactly the same. It's a blatant ripoff. And I don't know. I feel like I'm just kind of over that. I mean, I definitely think Chinatown Wars was the best example of that stuff.
But it played, at least functionally played, differently.
And that was also, that helped me.
It did,
because
yeah.
I was kind of sick of the 3D Grand Theft Auto
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, I feel like that crime genre has just been done to death.
Yeah, I got burned out on GTA 4 and didn't even finish it.
No, I didn't finish it either.
Not only is it, there's a lot of those games out there, they tend to go on for a long time.
Oh, man. Yeah, GTA 4 had terrible pacing.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Well, I mean, you know, I still have that DLC for GTA 4 that I haven't even touched. I don't even know why the hell I bought it now.
John's just waiting to the Ballad of Gay Tony so he can not play that, too.
Mm-hmm. I'm just waiting for it, man. I can't wait. I'm going to get it as soon as it goes up on Xbox Live, man. And then I'm just never going to play it again. There you go.
I don't understand the thinking of someone who goes through GTA 4 and thinks, man, I wish I had more.
Yeah.
I didn't have enough of that. I'm going to pay money for more of it.
Yeah, the funny thing is, too, it's like it doesn't even continue the real story. It's like a side story with a character that you don't care about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Maybe that's better, though. I mean, if you got tired of the story arc that was in the other game, you might, like, although... From what I've heard, the Lost and Damned was sort of more unremittingly bleak than the other one.
Greg, have you ever played one of these games?
I've seen them being played at friends and stuff. I've never owned one or really wanted to play one.
Yeah. I'd be curious what your take on it is, but I don't know if it's worth...
I'm a big structure guy. I just open stuff. I find it difficult to get on with it.
I hear you. It has to be done well.
I'm not closed off to the idea entirely. I like to keep an open mind about a lot of things, but it's just not... It doesn't appeal to me on that kind of immediate level.
That's where I am. I kind of got GTA 4 as sort of an experiment.
It was cheap, wasn't it?
It was dirt cheap. Yeah. I got it for next to nothing, and I figured, well, everybody in the world has played this game. I basically have to.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel with that whole series now. It's like everybody has played it, so it's not like somebody who's never played it before... You're not going to get some kind of objective, unbiased opinion on the series, because by now, either you love it or you hate it.
Well, I'm still playing Wii Fit Plus, which I think is a good thing. It's good for me, and it also says something good about Wii Fit Plus.
It's plus.
That it doesn't get old too fast. A lot of the new activities I actually really like. There's an interesting one where you're riding a bicycle.
Oh, God.
No, it's not like the one in Resort.
It's not that
one.
It's not that awful one.
No, you're not waggling. Actually, what you do is you just step. You kind of march on the balance board to pedal. And you hold a remote out, and you just tilt it to steer. And it's actually nice because it's a pretty good workout, and you like your lower calves and your heels and your Achilles tendon and everything. But the goal of it, it's untimed. You're not graded based on your time. You're graded on how efficiently you run the course. So you're kind of in this open field on Woohoo Island, and there are flags everywhere, and your goal is to just run around and tag all these flags. But you can do it in any order you want, and the goal is to basically find the shortest possible route, and that's how you're graded. So it's actually kind of surprising the way it's put together. But the best of the lot is the chicken game.
Oh,
I like the platformer one. That was quite good when I played it E3 London event.
It is very, very good.
I feel like that E3 was the absolute worst environment to show off Wii Fit Plus.
Well.
I mean, if you're remotely self-conscious, I imagine
well,
it would
no,
be anywhere.
Well, no, because your feet fucking hurt to no end. And they're like, okay.
That too, yeah.
Now get on a game where you use your feet to play it.
Well, but it's not as bad as like DDR. I played DDR once at E3 regretted it. I regret it for the rest of the trip. Oh man, that was brutal.
I think they showed the bike event at E3.
They had most of them there.
Yeah, I seem to recall playing that and just like, I cannot make bike go.
Yeah, well, outside of E3, it actually works quite well. That's one of the better ones. The Segway is definitely boring.
Oh God,
the Segway is
how much
just
money
silly.
Did they get to do that? Honestly.
I don't know. It's just there's no reason to play it. It's like, not fun.
At first it was the official Frisbee Band Frisbee throwing event. Now it's the Segway Tour.
Yeah. All right. Well, James, you're up next. And been playing anything new?
No, but I've completed things that I had just started for like a day when we last spoke.
Oh, yeah, like what?
Like Gras 2, that you completely are disinterested in.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I am.
Thanks. I have to say that the single-player game, even on the hardest setting, is really, really easy.
Because you're so good.
No, because if you're not completely idiotic, you can figure out how the game thinks and not die. So basically, it's like, all right, we're going to put you up against a bunch of completely untrained soldiers. Oh, but you're armed with all the best weapons in the world, have the ability to call down airstrikes, oh, and can shoot from behind walls, through walls, and hit them as you see them through walls.
So you're just like a super soldier.
Basically, yeah. So it's like, at the end of the game, it showed how many shots I'd fired, some ungodly number of bullets, and like I hit like 2% of the time. I hit like 175 soldiers, and it said I got hit 8 times.
So why can you shoot through walls?
Because the gun you have is like super high powered.
Oh, okay. So it's like one of those things like this is so realistic that you can shoot through walls with a super powerful gun.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
So it's like the railgun in Eraser.
Yeah, it's completely imbalanced.
Oh, yeah. Eraser reference for the win.
Oh, God.
Oh, man.
But I took it online yesterday after I completed the main mission, thinking, all right, I'm ready for this now.
No, you're not.
There is some hardcore, like, I'm like, what's that little twinkle of light? Oh, I'm dead.
Whoa.
Yeah.
But it's...
I told you, man. I told you that's what would happen.
In the game, you can give, you know, orders to your squad, which is questionable value. So basically, you can tell them to be aggressive or not. It's either they don't engage in combat, or they stand up behind their barricade, completely exposed, and just unload clip after clip after clip, and then seem upset when they get shot. It's like, well, the enemy AI is substantially better than the allied AI.
That's a common criticism of FPSs in general, though, isn't it? I mean,
yeah,
I heard the same thing about Killzone 2, you hear that about as mm-hmm. well. That it's got brilliant AI that goes against you, but then your squad mates are a bit dunderheaded.
Yeah, same thing with Gears of War has the same thing, too, with Death Wish Dom, as I like to call him. he just completely runs into, like, you know, you pick the biggest enemy in the game, and if you want to find him, he'll be right in front of the guy shooting at him, getting his ass beat down.
So, James, serious question. You and I both came into owning a 360, PS3, whatever, kind of late in the game, and so we're going back, and Greg can appreciate this too, we're going back and sort of catching up on some of the games. And, you know, sometimes I talk about a game that's been out for 2 years or whatever, but Gras 2 would be probably at the bottom of the list of games that I would want to go back and check out, you know, years later. I'm just wondering, what made you interested in going back and playing
this? Well, I played the original Ghost Recon demo when it first came out.
Mm-hmm.
Not on the 360, obviously. I played it on the PC. And it seemed like an interesting concept. And I always enjoy these kind of games where, in theory, you have to think on your feet. The idea that I would have to not only use some strategy in how I fight, but assign strategy to my dunderheaded allies.
Do you ever play Full Spectrum Warrior?
I haven't.
So it seems way more strategic than this, based on what I always heard.
I mean, it wasn't like I went out and said, I will go buy Gras 2 now. I went to the store, and this was the game that I ended up buying after about a half
like
hour.
I have a non-serious question, better or worse than Crowmount?
Oh, better. Much better.
Or what was the other one? Was it Armored Core that you bought?
Oh, God.
Armored Core 4 Answers.
Yes, that was another weird one where I'm like, wow, James, I have no idea why you bought that.
So really, it was, I wanted to play something that was fairly action-intensive that at least had some level of thought behind it. And that was how I ended up with this game. I just finished playing 2.5 weeks of puzzle games, for God's sakes. I needed something with a pulse.
You wanted something where you can shoot somebody in the face.
I get that.
I wanted to shoot Leighton in the face
times. You're imagining it was Maxwell and Luke together in an orgy of death.
I've got a puzzle for you, Leighton.
Hey, and let me say, you know, I may sound a little hypocritical here, because I just did talk about renting Saints Row 2, which probably a lot of people would put in the same boat as Gras 2. It's a little more recent, but actually the only reason I rented that is it came very, very, very highly recommended by a close friend of mine. And he was like, dude, Johnny Boy, you gotta play this, man, it's so cool. And
well, there's your lesson right there. Don't listen to guys who go, dude, you gotta play this, man, it's so cool.
I'm rather concerned with that caricature that he may no longer be a close friend of yours if you were to listen to this.
No, look, that is exactly how he talks, and he would agree. Anyway, no, I mean, he recommended it, and I said, okay, yeah, sure, if you like it so much, I'll put it on my Gamefly list or whatever. And, you know, it came in. It wasn't even at the top. Gamefly, it just seems random what game they send you. But anyway, I got it. I put it in. I sort of tried to like it, and he was telling me I should play, like, this particular line of missions, and so I'm trying to play through those and wait for it to get really visually captivating, and it didn't, and now it's back in the envelope, and it goes back tomorrow. So that's why. It wasn't... I didn't do a whole lot of research on Saints Row 2 beyond my friend said I should play it, so that's why.
And to further defend my position, sometimes...
don't need to defend your position.
Sometimes it's nice to just go to the store and say, the first game that jumps out at me that I know isn't a pile of crap. I'm going to go buy.
It's nice when you take it home and find out it's awesome.
I enjoyed playing Gra 2.
I wasn't implying it was
stupid, and the online is ridiculous, but yeah, it was fun. I mean,
no, I'm agreeing with you. Sometimes it's nice to go make a kind of impulse decision. You get home, you're like, man, what did I just do? And you put it in, and it turns out it's actually really cool.
I've done that a few times, and I've come home with crap a couple times, but
yeah,
James, you're still a good person.
I have a pretty good, thanks, John. I have a pretty good record.
Go on. You say what was the worst? Was it Chromance?
No, it wasn't Chromehounds.
Yeah, Chromehounds will be with him for a long time.
We're going further back into my gaming experience to find the worst. Oh. I've got some old PC games from back in the 90s that, like, I brought it home and I was like, when I was too young to really comprehend what makes a game good and bad.
You just picked the one with the best box art?
Oh my god, what did I just play?
I've been there.
Nancy Drew goes to the fair.
It was 1982, but I've been there.
Games have box art back then? Weren't they just graph paper with a foot drawn on it?
For the Master System, yeah. I remember my sister and I once saved up our our loose change and stuff for a long time. We rolled pennies and shit, and we wanted to go buy a video game. And, you know, we were like 6 years old, six or seven or whatever. We didn't have any money to do that. We usually only got games at Christmas or birthdays or something. So we decided we wanted to save up some money and roll some change and go to the store and pick up a game. And we didn't know what we were going to get. We hadn't even discussed it, really. We went there and we spent 20 minutes looking at all the boxes, and we walked out of there with Rampage for NES.
Oh my god!
Because it had a dinosaur on the box.
Yeah.
Not a dinosaur, but, you know, a Godzilla kind
Lizzie.
Of
thing. Lizzie on the box.
And a big
yes.
ape. And we thought it looked cool, and that's what
I
we
think
left
the,
there with.
The box art for Castlevania was pretty instrumental in us getting that, and I still
yeah,
play
I,
that
I can
series
say that
today.
For sure.
So it can still work. It can work out.
Yeah.
Which is exactly why Boomblox is a million seller.
I knew it was coming.
All right, well, we need to move on, and John has been playing supposedly like the best game of the year.
Yeah, game of the year, definitely. No, I can't say that. I've been playing Uncharted 2. Now, I haven't gotten too far into it. I haven't really had a whole lot of time. It's
he's gotten to the title screen.
No. I have actually.
He's still in the character creation mode.
Create a new save, and I can talk about this boy on RFN.
Don't put it past me.
Oh, I haven't. Don't worry.
Don't worry. We assume.
All right, so Uncharted 2. I don't know who here has played Uncharted 1. I don't know if anybody has.
I've only played the demo, which you're saying is really bad and unrepresentative of the quality of that game.
Yeah, see, the thing is with the Uncharted 1 demo, I've heard a lot of negative things about it. Like people that haven't played, that haven't really played through Uncharted 1 say that they didn't play the game because they didn't like that demo.
Yeah, it's not a good demo. You're kind of in a jungle, and there's a little bit of jumping around, but within, like, the first minute or two, people start shooting at you, and that's when it really falls apart.
Yeah.
When the game starts being this game.
Well, no, I mean, I like the climbing around, the Tomb Raider kind of stuff, but then they throw you in this fight where these guys that will not die, no matter how much you shoot at them, and they just keep coming and coming and coming. They totally surround you. They pick you off. You run out of ammo really easily. And I just got super frustrated with it.
Yeah, that amazes me because, I mean, when you play through Uncharted, I mean, it's not like that at all. Like, that's why I was really surprised at people getting such a bad opinion of the game. Because, granted, the first Uncharted, there were a lot of parts that were very repetitive. Like, you know, like you pretty much get tossed into an area and you can't move forward until you kill all the guys. So it's a lot of kind of Gears of War style, hiding behind something, poking up, shooting people. There's a lot of that, but that only really gets repetitive in a couple of areas of the game that are kind of the longest areas. I mean, the thing is, there's a lot of other stuff that you do in that game. Like, there's a lot of climbing on walls, a lot of puzzle solving, and there's also one jet ski area where you hop onto a jet ski. There's an area where you drive around a Jeep. You're being chased by some people. There's a whole lot of stuff in that game, so I think they picked the part of the game that would probably give the worst first impression. Which I think is too bad. I think it probably turned off a lot of people to the game. That,
John, do you ever fight a bear?
No, unfortunately, you do not.
Do you ever see a tornado?
Can't say you do.
Does a volcano ever erupt in the middle of a city?
No.
Shut the hell up. Next game.
James is the odd man out here. He doesn't have a PS3, so he's getting jealous that you're playing Uncharted 2.
Well, I will say that Uncharted 2 is no Day of Crisis. I will say that.
Damn right it's not.
I could definitely make that statement. So there's really no room for a bearist like yourself.
But I guess it sounds like from what people are saying that the sequel to Uncharted is way, 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 way better than the first one, like in a different league of quality.
Well, it's interesting because one of the things that really wasn't too prominent in the first game was like a stealth element. And they kind of like, not to spoil anything, but Uncharted 2, it starts you off with a stealth element. You don't get into the gunplay until I'm actually not at the point where you get to the gunplay. I'm right there. But the first maybe hour of the game is kind of you with another guy going through this kind of stealthy area, having to sneak up behind people and stuff. A little bit like Metal Gear Solid-ish. So they definitely switched things up. I think they probably took a cue, like, you know, people like things broken up more. It's not just like, oh, here's another area where I have to kill everybody. So right off the bat, they kind of edge you into it. And it's also kind of a good, and, you know, thinking of, you know, what you said, Johnny, about the original demo, it's also a good tutorial to get you slowly accustomed to the controls. You know, it's like they give you a gun, then they take it away from you so you can kind of focus on the melee kind of fighting. And so to me, it's like, because I played the first game, it's not like it's leaps and bounds, or it's not like it reinvents the game or anything like that.
It was pretty well received, the first one, wasn't it?
I mean, I know.
some people did have problems with the gunplay not being that great and, you know, maybe being a bit much in certain areas. But my understanding is, from looking into it as a possible sort of purchase, because you can get it cheap these days, is that, you know, that's really well regarded. But Johnny's right. I mean, there seems to have been some sort of significant elevation that's occurred, apparently.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think it just seems the whole kind of experience seems smoother overall. They've also, you know, made a couple of tweaks to the way you can handle, like, moving around corners. Just very small things. Like, if you played the first game, you'll notice it's just a little bit different and probably controls a little bit smoother, makes a bit more sense. Because I heard a lot of people compare the first game to Gears of War, which is kind of... the thing is with Gears of War is... the story takes a backseat to the combat, whereas in Uncharted, the combat is secondary to the story. So I think in Uncharted, that's one of the reasons why I like the first one, is because, yeah, the combat got a little bit repetitive, but it's really not what you're there for. You're really, like, the combat really just serves to kind of move through an area and keep the story going.
And pad it a little bit.
Kinda.
Because you said it was used a lot in the longer levels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep it going a bit. But, of course, this adds multiplayer. Are you bothered about that at all?
Well, the thing is, it's funny because I did play the multiplayer beta. And I wasn't too jazzed on it. I thought it was kind of shoehorned into the game engine. I don't know. It just seemed kind of awkward.
It's interesting sort of trend. So you've got some really well-received games from early on in this generation on the HD consoles, like Bioshock and Uncharted, feeling the need to put a multiplayer mode in the second game.
Metroid Prime 2? Anyone?
Yeah, I was going to say, it reminds you of that, doesn't it? And it just seems like, I mean, perhaps these modes, they may be better than Metroid Prime 2's mode relatively or whatever.
Get the cannon first and win the game mode?
In whatever way, it does seem like you're caving into something that, you know, I don't know whether it's worthwhile.
It's the same thing with Metal Gear 4. I mean Metal Gear Online. That was my first impression of Uncharted 2's multiplayer in the beta. Like, if you play Metal Gear Online, it just feels really awkward because you know how the controls in Metal Gear Solid 4, for those that have played it, they're kind of stiff, but they work because the game isn't really asking you to do anything too dramatic action-wise.
Sure.
And I kind of get that vibe sort of from Uncharted 2's multiplayer, but I mean, what my aim right now is to play through the single player, because that's really...
Yeah, sure.
I want to see the story, because the story is actually really, really good.
Well, my big question for you, John, is does your wife think it's a movie?
That is the stupidest freaking commercial.
I'm trying to get her to actually watch me play through it because, you know, it's funny.
Are you going to try to trick her? You're going to...
Ignore the guy playing with the controller.
I just haven't got a Blu-ray remote yet. I'm just fiddling.
That really is...
I just shake my head at that commercial. That thing is just terrible. It's terrible.
How unfocused is Sony's advertising department?
Seriously. But, I mean, it is that kind of game, though, where I think people will enjoy it. Much like, actually, Gears of War was like that, too, where it's kind of like you walk by the screen and you're like, holy crap, that looks amazing. And then you have to sit down
that
and kind of
solids like
just
that.
Watch
well,
it.
It really is a movie, so it's fun.
Yeah. Exactly.
Nice. Very nice.
But, yeah, I mean, Uncharted, I mean, that's one of the things that always impressed me with the first one is, and kind of like what I forgot about the first one was how seamlessly, I mean, like all the cutscenes use the in-game engine. So it just moves seamlessly between the two. And I mean, it's really good. There's so many like kind of small things. I mean, it's not like, even like I was thinking about the cutscenes in GTA 4 where those cutscenes are good, but...
No, they're not. I don't think they're that good.
Well, yeah, the thing is, though, the engine... I mean, I think the engine in GTA 4 is really good, but the thing is, those cutscenes are still really, like Nico is very robotic.
Well, and it's all just guys standing around in a room cussing at each other. Mm-hmm.
Like this, only they're in a room and not... on the internet.
But I'm talking about, like the physical actions. Like, Nico's face... still, he's still like kind of blankly staring into space, even though
that's what he does the whole game, John. I mean, honestly,
but you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing there to immerse you.
Yeah, I mean, surely if you're doing sort of more focused cinematic type experience like Uncharted 2, it's a lot easier to do the rigorous motion capture stuff and you know, really put loads of effort into that rather than, you know, God knows how much interaction you could have in GTA with all the different things you can do in something like an open world game like that.
Would you really want it? In that game, is it really advantageous in GTA where basically the premise is everybody in this game is an asshole?
Yeah, and at some point,
you'll have to kill most of them.
I know we're kicking on this game a lot, but I mean, I think in GTA 4, I just got to where I was sick of the story. There's just too much of it. There's too much of everything
it's
in that.
It's not an uplifting story either. So it
no, and I think part of it's what Greg was saying is that because it's a non-linear sort of open structured thing, it's harder to tell a good story. Mm-hmm. And it seems like in a game like Uncharted, it makes more sense.
Well, that's the thing. Like what I'm getting at is when you talk to somebody face to face, there are certain subtle physical cues, like just small things, like, you know, like maybe they'll divert their eyes somewhere, or maybe they'll scratch their arm or something like that. That kind of stuff takes place in the cutscenes in Uncharted, and it's the only game I've ever seen do that, and that's why the cutscenes are so realistic, and they look like professionally acted cutscenes. Like, it looks very much like something like that you would see in a Pixar movie. You know how, you know that they're all computer-generated characters, but they have these subtle little things that they do that are just, like, extras. They're not just sitting there staring at somebody and their lips are moving and the lines are synced to them. You know, they're sitting there and they're kind of like, you know, rolling their eyes, or they're like, you know,
they're licking their lips at you.
Well, there's stuff like that. Like there's like inflections in the voice. You know, their eyes will maybe like look down at a person's shirt or look at something else.
Look
or...
down someone's shirt, John? Jeez.
Maybe.
If you can pull all that off without being creepy, then it really works.
Yeah, I guess that's a point. Yeah, it's still got to come across as organic. Yeah.
You remember when Spirits Within came out in the theaters and all the movie critics were like, it just feels like
it just feels
like
creepy.
Ghost puppets talking to each other.
That's my point. Well, I mean, it seems like. Well, I mean, like, I think Greg hit on it was the word organic. It doesn't feel like I'm sitting here watching a couple of robotic CGI puppets. It seems like the scenes are being acted by real people with actual personalities.
I mean, that's the sum total of everything, isn't it? The writing, the voice acting, the motion capture, that's, I mean, I guess that's got to be everything. So it's difficult to encapsulate it in a single technical aspect. But when it all comes together. I mean, I'm interested in this game.
Yeah, I am too. I want to play the first one first.
To buy the second one would cost thrice as much as buying the first, and I'm not convinced that it's three times as good.
No, I wouldn't say that either.
I may buy the first one first.
I would say definitely buy the first one first. And I mean, if you like it, the second one is that kind of taken up a notch.
All right. That sounds good. Now, Greg, I heard that our podcast is sometimes about Nintendo games. And counting on you, man.
Yes, well, the first thing I'm going to bring up is that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that the Virtual Console in Japan was going to hit the big 500, and it did this past week. And the game that... it was three games, as is often the case in Japan, two or three, which is obviously a very foreign concept to us at this point.
Games.
But I guess the headliner of the three, which you might designate as the 500th, was Kirby Superstar, which is kind of interesting because, of course, it was fairly recently remade as a DS game.
Right.
But it came out in Japan about a year ago at this point, and there's a bit of a movement towards some of these games that had DS remakes in the not-too-distant past getting released on Virtual Console in Japan. For instance, Final Fantasy IV, and I think Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon is coming this month as well. So it seems like they kind of just waited for 12 months to expire, some sort of statute of limitations, and then they'll put it up. For me, I'll probably go with Kirby Superstar because it's just much more attractive at that price than buying a DS game.
It's cheaper.
Portability is all well and good, but
the language barrier is not exactly significant.
Oh, no, either. No, definitely not exactly.
How will I understand this complex story?
And I mean, it's supposed to have a really cool soundtrack and all that. I mean, I'm not a Kirby guy by any means.
Kirby Superstar is a great game.
Yeah, I've never really played a proper Kirby game, to be fair, to know whether I would like it or not. I just, from the things you hear, I wouldn't necessarily think it would appeal to me a great deal. But I mean, the ones I have played are Canvas Curse and Amazing Mirror, which are quite different from the sort of standard Kirby game.
Well, this will be more like Amazing Mirror for sure.
Yeah, I guess so. But out of those two, certainly.
This is the one that's, because I played a bunch of them. This is the one that's all different little mini games, right?
Yeah, so it's like eight games in one.
This is very good.
Yeah, oh yeah. No, I know Stephen Windyman Rodriguez thinks this is brilliant.
And TYP loves it as well.
Yeah, lots of people do it. It's got a really good soundtrack from what I mean. I'd be quite like to have the original Super NES soundtrack as well. Just there's something warm and fuzzy that radiates from Super NES soundtracks for me. And then also from Japan, I tried the PS3 demo for Bayonetta.
This does not seem like your kind of game, Greg.
No, well, I was setting up a Japanese PSN account, and it was new on there, so I thought, well, this is current. So I tried, and, you know, I do like what Clover did, you know, when they were still Clover. Beautiful Joe.
They've never made a game like this, really, like Bayonetta.
Mad World, you know, didn't really pan out for me for various reasons. But, you know, I'm still interested in what they're up to these days, so I thought I'd give this a look. And the first thing that was quite interesting for someone who'd been on the other side of the HD console gaming fence for a while is I did get to see what screen tearing looks like, which was fun. It's really bad.
It is, yes.
It's very obtrusive in this, and the frame rate's really bad at times, even in the cutscenes. And I mean, everything you may have heard about the PS3 version being really dodgy because it's not actually made by Platinum, it's being handled by Sega, the publisher. It appears to be true. This is not a good advertisement for the game.
I like to think of it more as screen tearing.
Your screen is actually crying.
But, you know, having played some of the game, it's as every bit as absurd as you would expect based on the premise, and completely over the top. These bizarre finishing moves that you perform are like giant spectral high heels kicking things into the ground. And at one point, an Iron Maiden appeared out of nowhere, and you just chucked an enemy in there. And
perfect.
It is, you know, sort of gloriously silly. But, I mean, it seems like it could be, you know, decent fun, like, performing different combos and stuff. It is just so ridiculous, it's kind of interesting to see what it does next. But it's also kind of ghastly as well.
Have you ever played a Devil May Cry game?
No, I've never played Devil May Cry. I've never played God of War, anything like that.
Yeah. I think both of those games are somewhat more tasteful than Bayonetta probably is.
Yeah, probably.
You think?
You know.
I think a trauma film might be more tasteful than Bayonetta.
Oh, God. Toxie. Yeah. It's good stuff.
Or my personal favorite, the Hermaphrodite Killer.
Perfect. God. Killer Condom is quite interesting. I've seen that, yeah. It's in German.
But it was just interesting to see that, you know. But yeah, I don't think that's going to be anything that I'm going to delve into. But yeah, that's the cool thing about the PS3 or the 360. You can just play demos and see things that, you know, you otherwise wouldn't really get to see at all.
It is nice.
Demos, crazy.
But to finally get on to what I've really been playing this week, so I picked up Mario & Luigi 3, Bowser's Inside Story. Well, it's not officially called 3, but it's the third game in the series, as everyone should know. And yeah, I got this the day after we recorded last week, so by now I've put in about 10 hours, which from what I've heard around is probably somewhere in the region of halfway through the game. So I've played it a reasonable amount. And, I mean, I was really looking forward to this. So I was really looking forward to it anyway because I really like the Mario & Luigi games. The original, the Superstar Saga, was the first Mario RPG I ever played.
and I thought it was really, really good. I really enjoyed that. Not being an RPG person in particular, but just how active the sort of battle system was and the exploration, platforming kind of stuff and all that. It was definitely how I would like to see a sort of RPG handled, a lot more engaging. So I really like it. And I've gone back and I've played Paper Mario and Super Mario RPG on the Virtual Console stuff, and I like those, but I guess that Superstar Saga holds a sort of special place for me because it was the first one I played. And Partners in Time had its issues and all that, so you come to this one, the more development time and everything, I was really looking forward to it, and having played it at the E3 demo event in London and everything, I knew it was going to be gorgeous, and I mean, it is. I think it's probably one of the most beautiful games on DS, if not the most. Obviously, I haven't played nearly all of them, but it's wonderful looking.
Yeah, I thought the E3 demo was probably the best looking DS demo I saw there at the show. Yeah, I was blown away by the animations and the clarity of the art is fantastic.
Yeah, the animations are really excellent. I mean, seriously, the difference between this and Partners in Time is drastic, to say the least. And what that does is that, other than just looking nice generally, I mean, certainly the cutscenes, if you want to call them that, you know, the dialogue parts, the sort of little bits of acting that the sprites can do now is more substantial. And it just works a lot better that way. And also in the battle scenes, kind of, it all plays out much more kind of smoothly and everything. It just looks wonderful. And then, other than that, like you said, it's the art style, the way it is, it's so vibrant and so distinct. And it's got this really sort of chunky kind of feel to it that it didn't have before. Everything seems very big and very detailed, like you're kind of closer in.
Is it kind of like when they made the jump from the SNES style of Zelda games on the Game Boy Advance to the Minish Cap, where everything got...
Especially, yeah, when you're small in Minish Cap.
Yes, exactly.
Especially, mm-hmm. It is like, it does feel a bit like that. So, as I said, it's got this kind of, this detail and sort of, drawn-in lighting and things like that that just really bring it to life, give it a bit of a comic book feel, but it's still obviously very much the same art style as you've had before.
Right.
And I think I said this when I played the E3 demo, it's kind of like bringing the old art style to life in a much greater way than it did before. So that's the first thing. It just looks great, and the music's good and all that. But in terms of the gameplay and the story and all sorts of things, I mean, first of all, you've got Bowser as a big, as a protagonist, essentially, which is a bit different from him sort of being a party member, which he kind of is in quite a few of the Mario RPGs. And he's always great in the Mario RPGs. He's always funny. He's just naturally funny. He's this sort of big oaf, this big narcissist. And they really make it sort of, they make hay out of that in this, because I think the cool thing about it is that, that whole silent protagonist shtick that's in every Nintendo game, and especially in RPGs as well, can wear a little thin. And obviously that's still in this. You've still got Mario and Luigi sort of giving their Italian gobbledygook while, everyone else, everyone speaks to you about something. But because that's broken up with dialogue scenes with Bowser, where he's actually having dialogue, actually exchanging and being very funny and being very self-absorbed and stuff like that, it just works better. It breaks it up, and, the Mario stuff doesn't get as tired as a result. And the same sort of thing extends into the gameplay, because Bowser does play quite differently. The sort of platforming elements when you're exploring the overworld don't really exist in the same way with Bowser, because he can't jump. What he can do is this sort of dash punch and like a body slam and all this stuff. He's this big tank that breathes fire. He's very satisfying to play as. He's just, it's really, that part of it is really wonderful. And in battle, you've got these different special attacks which use the stylus instead. And the cool thing about that, really, I would say, is that they are different. They're very different from Mario and Luigi's, which are, in some cases, exactly the same as has been in previous games. And in others, they've got new ones, which are quite cool and quite different, where you're actually, moving characters around with the D-pad and things. So it's even more interactive than it's been before. But with Bowser stuff, it works because you, at least in the half of the game that I've played, you're not ever having to do it that often. It's kind of like you pull it out every now and again, it's a novelty, it'll inflict a lot of damage if you do it right, but it's not something that needs to be a staple diet if you're playing it, because I think that would get tired.
Well, it sort of did in Partners in Time with the, you know, when you would use the special items, which were really your special attacks. Towards the end of the game, you pretty much had to use multiple special items every single battle just to get through it. And they tended to be very drawn out.
Yes, I think that is an important point because, I mean, they could still be fairly drawn out here. I'm not sure if they're quite as drawn out as they were in Mario & Luigi Partners in Time, but that's the point. Time will tell with that. I mean, I will have more to say about this and just how it stacks up with the other games and in general, because the second half of the game was certainly an area where Partners in Time didn't quite maintain the level of quality.
Yeah. Oh, it just got tedious.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, especially in the battles. But I mean, with this so far, they've met. You know, having the greater variety in the battles is good. The two different kinds of overworld exploration is really good because, of course, Mario and Luigi, when they're inside Bowser's body, is actually like it's side scrolling now. You know, it's literally sort of like a platform, platform game. Although the mechanics are pretty much the same. Yeah. I mean, it reminds me quite a lot, actually, of the Goemon 3 that I've been playing, in a way. Well, you have not so much like with enemies, of course, because it's turn-based combat. But in terms of the kind of exploration and the puzzle solving, kind of like being in a dungeon, it's quite similar. And the other thing that's similar about it is that you get giant Bowser boss battles, a bit like the Impact boss battles, although they play quite differently, but still the sort of Power Ranger-ness of it is very apparent. And they're kind of fun, just how silly they are. And some of them are quite cool, although, you know, blowing into the microphone is never something that I find particular. I mean, it's so perfunctory. It doesn't really hurt the gameplay experience that much, but by the same token, it's like, really?
Yeah, well, I mean, but that is what microphones are for.
Yeah, I guess the only real concrete complaint I would have at this stage is that sometimes you've got these little interactions between Bowser and the Mario Brothers inside of him, where they're trying to help him out sort of inside his body or make him stronger, regain his health or whatever, and you play these little mini games in his body. And the first time is kind of fun. It's like, okay, this time we're in Bowser's nose and we're doing this, or, you know, we're in his leg muscles or whatever. But sometimes they're reprised very soon after the first time you did it. And if they're not that great to start with, and then you're doing it again, that feels like going through the motions. So, yeah, they're not that bad per se. I mean, the one where you're sort of bolstering his muscles, it could almost be a game in Rhythm Tengoku. It's very similar if it was sort of expanded. You know, it's completely rhythm-based, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yeah, so they're not bad in themselves, but they, you know, on the occasions where they've been repeated rapidly, it's just that's not great. But other than that, I'm very, very pleased with it so far. And yeah, it's got all the little self-aware touches that you're used to at this point. From I think there's a bit where you need to use a special laser on Bowser's body to make it transparent, which is sort of based off ghosts, which they call the Boo-ray machine.
A Boo-ray player.
They brought back Thorfinn from the first one, and many people sort of seem to fondly remember as the primary villain.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's very funny.
Yeah, you get a lot more of him now, which I don't know whether it's the best thing in the world. His shtick gets a little thin. compared to the first one, but this still, you know, he's sort of broken English garblings. There still is some really amusingly bizarre lines that come out of him. Like, it's still good.
Well, I'm really looking forward to playing this. I'm definitely going to pick it up probably at the end of the month. I've got some travel coming up, and a lot of times I'll reserve DS game purchases until it's time for me to travel, and that way I can really jump into it and focus on it. But I was just thinking, it's very, very strange and disappointing that they haven't put the put a demo of this on Nintendo Channel. I mean, I thought that the demo that they had at E3 and that you played at the post E3 event in London, I thought was fabulous. I mean, it totally sold me on the game, and I'm just like, why not just dump that on the service and let people get it for themselves?
I agree. I mean, their policies about this sort of thing are quite strange. I mean, in Japan, you know, they still haven't done a demo for that Chibi Robo game. You know, the new game for DS. I mean, you know, they've got one for bloody economy training. I'm not kidding. That's real. There is a sort of economics common sense training game in Japan which has a demo on the Nintendo Channel, and you know the friend collection and almost every first party thing. But not.
Oh yeah, you
GD
can still
Robert.
Get Flash Focus in the U.S. I don't know why you'd want to.
Nice.
But why can I download that demo and not Mario and Luigi?
Very odd indeed, isn't it?
Makes no sense. All right, well, that's going to wrap up new business. It's time for a break. When we come back, your listener mail. Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com. There's plenty of stuff to talk about this week as the holiday season kicks into gear.
We have an exclusive new feature for you as we begin our developer diary with Metaverse Studios. Also, don't forget to check out the return of the NWR Newscast featuring our new crew of Lucas Belitsky, Zach Miller, and Andy Gergen.
There's also a ton of reviews as we give our take on Dead Space Extraction, Dirt 2, and Thorium Wars.
Of course, we have even more news and reviews to read at NintendoWorldReport.com. Be sure to check it out. So we're back for your listener mail, and these people, of course, wrote into rfn at nintendoworldreport.com, and so can you. Now, the first letter is from Rob, who writes, "Hey RFN, I'm a new listener and a podcast junkie. Before I begin my question, let me just say that you guys are now at the top of my playlist each week for gaming discussions. You have dethroned some pretty big podcasts from my iPod. I have no clue what you look like, but from voices alone, I picture Johnny being like Michael on Family Ties, no. The dad of the group, always trying to keep James and Greg straight. James reminds me of a kid who just learned the F word from hearing his first Eminem song. And Greg is like the older brother who is always in the basement playing games. Greg, every time you laugh, tee-hee-hee, it reminds me of my pot-smoking uncle who thinks Ernest Goes to Camp is the funniest movie of all time. By the way, if Greg recommends a game, I get it. No questions asked. John is more like the older brother who everyone forgets about and is either A, left the house to go fight in the war, or B, doesn't want to be seen with his two younger brothers, especially when he's the older, more mature sibling. Think Wayne from the Wonder Years, always picking on Kevin and Paul."
Maybe little Wayne.
Pause. We're going to pause this letter and have rebuttals.
Oh, my God. This is the least accurate letter that has ever been sent in email in the history of the world.
I think it's great.
Like every single person's characterization in there is just blatantly wrong.
I mean, James isn't even like Eminem.
No.
Well, Michael on Family Ties, I don't know if he means Michael J. Fox, because he was the kid on Family Ties.
Yeah, he was
not
young,
the dad.
I guess the dad was called Michael, was he?
I wouldn't know that.
John, you were 30 when the show came out. You tell us, what was it like?
Oh, man.
Let's go back to the early 80s. I was
what
too young
would
for
we
Family
do,
Ties.
Baby? Without us.
By the way, this is the guy that he said went off to go fight in a war or something.
Amazing. Yes.
Michael.
I thought he went
to
Canada to get out of going to the war. John's coming in the opposite direction.
John, you're like all the veterans I know. Just
a little bit more flamboyant.
Michael on Family Ties, I mean, I'm assuming he means Michael J. Fox, who would be Alex P. Keaton. So just to correct you there, Rob.
Oh.
Alex P. Keaton.
I ain't nobody's daddy. Let me put it that way.
I don't even know where to go with this letter. I mean...
No, well, I will get my... I did some, you know, what I
Craig
consider
has
to
talking
be...
points.
This is what I consider to be some pretty serious accusations by implication here that I want to address. So, first of all... I mean, one thing absolutely clear. I do not think that Ernest Goes to Camp is the funniest movie of all time.
Clearly, Ernest Saves Halloween is a superior, title.
There may have been times when I would have been in a room with a television set with an Ernest film on at the same time. I certainly would not have inhaled at any point during that experience.
It's already trippy enough.
Everybody knows Ernest Goes to Jail is the best Ernest movie.
I think
best
Ernest movie is Ernest Goes Somewhere Cheap, because that's from The Simpsons and doesn't actually exist.
No, Ernest Goes to Jail is by far the funniest.
Is that a lot like The Shawshank Redemption or any little?
It is very similar. Much. It's very much except that when he goes to the electric chair, It gives him magical electricity powers perfect. That he uses to break out of jail.
So it's a lot like Wes Craven's Shocker, then. Oh,
yeah.
I'm going to say the best Ernest movie is the poster that we had with in French class with him displaying emotions with the word French words for emotions under it.
Yes,
that's pretty much as much as I could tolerate of him.
When I think Ernest, I think French.
Yep. It was the highlight of the classroom, to say the least.
Oui, oui.
I'm going to go on to say that, A, I don't swear nearly as much in person as I do on the podcast. I don't think...
Really?
I fucking don't,
all right?
God. There is a certain amount of... Play up emotion on the podcast because it's an audio format and you can't see what I'm doing.
Acting!
Thank God. Sometimes I don't want to see what you're doing, James.
I mean, I do swear a fair amount, but it's not like I just learned to swear either. I've been swearing since I was like 4.
Yeah, I would say probably on the podcast. No, I probably swear more than you, James.
Yeah.
I'm a potty mouth a little bit. I mean, I'll admit that.
Yeah.
It's not unusual for me to swear in normal conversation, but I don't really think of them as special words set aside for, like, don't say these words.
Well, let me just go back to what you were saying a little bit, James, in that I think, I mean, you're claiming that you kind of play up emotions or whatever on the podcast, but I have to say, I mean, and you're not unique in this regard, but I feel like all the people on our website who I've ever gotten to meet in person at something like E3 were pretty much exactly what I expected. I'm serious. I've always felt that the people on our staff, because, you know, we're not role playing in our staff meetings or in our emails where we're discussing what to do about this news story. Like, we're being ourselves. And I've always felt that when I met people from the site in person, that I may not have known what they were going to look like, but I've always felt that they acted pretty much exactly the way I would expect. And the only difference is some people are a little more introverted in person than they are online. But other than that,
I'm not implying that I act differently. It's just that how I inflect my voice and how I speak and some of the words I might use might be different.
A little bit, yeah. Yeah, you seemed a little more defeated at E3, but that's physical fatigue as well.
Well, that was because I was dealing with the just disgusting feeling of having flown ungodly amount of hours and gotten sick on the plane.
Yeah, you were pretty stressed at E3.
I think the only time I let a swear go in a situation that was inappropriate during that trip was at the event for the Games for Girls thing that Nick and I ended up at. That was the only time that it was socially inappropriate for me to have sworn that I did. But in my defense, it was the only thing in that event that was actually worth seeing because Nick just started laughing.
So was it anything special, or was it just your standard?
It's the game where you tease up their hair to
it was
to
that
the,
game,
up into
yes.
the upper screen of the DS. Yeah, right?
No, I mean, was the profanity anything special?
Yeah, it was just, I think I just said something like, Nick, this is the most fucking lame thing I've ever seen in my life.
Anyway, okay, let's finish this long email from Rob here. Are used gaming stores killing the gaming industry?
Oh, God.
It's just such a great transition.
But wait, there's more.
Okay, are used gaming stores killing the gaming industry? Every time I'm in a certain store in America, which will remain nameless,
GameStop.
They're always pushing their used games instead of buying new. The pitch is that I can return it in 7 days if I don't like it. I love this option, but I find that when I'm playing a game that I purchased used there, there's this voice in my head that tells me I should either finish the game as quickly as possible to get it back within the 7 days so I can get another one, or I become really critical and start wondering if the game is a keeper. Do you find that this creates a never-ending cycle, and wouldn't this hurt the gaming industry in the long run? Sorry for the length, love the show, word to your mother, Rob. And it says here Rob is the co-host of Weekend Wine. Check it out on iTunes. So I'm happy to include that. It's hardly a competitor to our show.
It says Weeknight Wine here.
Weeknight Wine, yes.
I am aware of the seven-day policy thing.
I've never used it.
Now, is this actually at GameStop or is it somewhere else? Is it Game Crazy or something?
I'm pretty sure it's GameStop, yeah.
Yeah, I believe it is, yeah. But I've never felt the urge to complete a game so I can make use of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, if I hate a game, I hate the game. I put it away. I'm like, well, that was a waste of money. It's like it's a training situation.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I never buy used games unless it's last generation stuff. You know, like I bought Geist used because you can't get it new.
I did get it new, actually.
It's tough.
There's actually something I wanted to point out about my copy of Geist. My copy of Geist is from French Canada.
Nice.
So the box art has French all over it. It's good.
And my Luigi's Mansion that I got for Retroactive, that was used. But generally speaking, I'm not really aware of this phenomenon. I only buy new games in general, but I buy very few of them. I mean, I'm very selective. I don't buy games wondering if I'm going to like it or not like James does.
Yeah.
I'm pretty damn sure before I go. For one thing, when I walk into GameStop, which I do as few times as possible, but when I walk into a GameStop, I know what I'm going to buy. I walk there, I take it to the front, and then they try to sell me about 10 things that I don't want. And I say, no, no, and I just laugh at them, and I try to make it as clear as quickly as possible that I'm not interested in all their bullshit, and I just want to give them my money and leave.
You see, I haven't seen that as much as I used to see it. It used to be like, do you want to get the insurance? Do you want the magazine? Do you like to reserve a game? They don't really do that as much as
they tried to sell me a guide for Metroid Prime Trilogy. I'm like, dude, I've already beaten all three of these games.
Yeah. I could still use a guide for Metroid Prime 2. Thank you.
But it's two sides of the coin with this one, isn't there? Because on the one hand, it's like, yeah, it's hurting it might be hurting publishers because you're going to get fewer new sales, and it kind of puts this pressure on price and all this sort of thing. But then on the other hand, you wonder to what extent, how many console owners might it take away if there wasn't the knowledge that that gaming was kind of more affordable because of this thing for some people, or how many people wouldn't buy a game new if you didn't have this sort of safeguard against buyer's remorse.
I have a good friend of mine just bought a 360, and he does not buy new games.
I very rarely buy new games for my 360.
And the thing is, he's just not interested in, having... He doesn't really care about having the newest and greatest out there. So.
Yeah, that's right. Basically where I am on the 360.
He's a budget gamer.
I've never bought a game for the 360 that's not at least 6 months old. It just hasn't happened yet.
And I mean, in the event that you didn't have a used game industry, the way you do here, if the prices still remained relatively high, hypothetically, you could have therefore fewer people with consoles, which obviously would hurt the industry. So it's not unambiguous in which direction this acts, other than to say that obviously it swells the retailers' coffers because they make ridiculous margins on these things.
Oh, yeah.
Because you get a little amount of trading credit and then they sell it fairly close to retail price. So
one thing that would be really tragic if we didn't have a used game industry would be that we would be stuck with copies of Miami Knights Singles in the City in our homes.
That's true.
We, using the royal
one
we,
man, the royal stuck way. With Miami Knights in his home.
That represents
we would
all
not
of
have
mankind.
The extreme displeasure of having seen the game disappear from the store shelves and then reappear sometime later.
Yeah.
Because at that point you realize, now twice, your review has failed.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you tried, James. You tried to warn them.
Yep.
Well, I think, look, I mean, in terms of the morality of buying used games, it's not that much different from renting, which I've done my entire life. I've never felt guilty about it, because games are expensive, and I can't afford to fulfill the appetite that I have for them. I never have been able to. I probably never will. And then the other thing is, I tend to think that all this does is it sort of stratifies the market so that it makes maybe certain kinds of games will be more successful because for whatever reason, you're more inclined to buy them when they first come out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Or they appeal to the kind of consumer who's going to buy things when they first come out anyway. And you've seen that quite a bit, I think, with video games, is that they've sort of targeted these early adopter people.
Oh yeah, they're doing it in a variety of ways. Publishers now, I mean, first of all, they sort of milk the people with plenty of disposable income or the real enthusiasts with these collector's editions. So that's kind of price discrimination. It's always quote unquote limited, so you better pre-order it now and pay over the odds.
Well, and
think about
the terminology of collector's edition.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
If you're a collector, you're not gonna trade it in.
Yes.
That's the whole point. Is to buy it and keep it.
And you, There's also like pre-order bonuses or exclusive retailer bonuses. Like if you buy this from GameStop, you get access to play as this dumbass in the online.
And that, and then you took. Now you're getting into a position where it's like, okay, well, we're going to put in like download codes or something when it's a new game. That then when it's traded isn't going to work. So you know you're not getting all the same functionality if you buy a used game. I mean that's kind
that
of where
is retarded.
Yeah,
if you're going to do that, just let me download it to begin with. I'm happy to do that. You know, I like digital distribution. And obviously that circumvents the whole used game phenomenon.
Exactly.
And I think that's a totally legitimate way for publishers and platform owners to deal with this problem, if it is a problem.
That's not in our best interest, though.
We've had libraries for thousands of years where you can basically check out books for free, read them, you use them when you're done, you take it back. There's no money changing hands here. And, you know, they still make books. Mm-hmm. They still do new book releases. They still publish 10 million copies of Harry Potter.
Despite my best efforts, books are still being made.
I happen to like books, James.
James just dropped into a time machine and destroyed Alexander the Great's library. That's it.
No matter how many I burn, they're still around.
Such is his hatred for knowledge. it's true, though. I mean, and obviously digital distribution in general is kind of a counter to it, but I don't think that it would be healthy to eliminate the used game market entirely at all.
I would agree.
Because, as you said, it is a strata, of a layer of the market that's there. And I think the publishers would probably be more willing to tolerate it if they feel happier that they're kind of... You know, maybe they shrink it a little. Maybe they extract more money out of the people in the upper strata of the market, and then they're happier with that balance. And that's the movement we're going towards, with more digital distribution, pre-order bonuses, and these little extras, basically.
Yeah,
but the
whole used game market has been around for 20 years in one form or another, mm-hmm. as have game rentals and all these other things that publishers hate. And has it destroyed the game industry? Has it led to a crash?
No. But you know what it is, though, Johnny? It's because the pie is so much bigger, they want more of it. That's why.
The thing is it probably does benefit the industry in ways that are not immediately obvious. That I don't have this very direct sort of cause and effect on company balance sheets. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, overall... You know, if you get people who think like maybe they can convince their parents, you know, on the basis that, look, well, you don't have to pay this much money for the games. If I don't like it, there's recourse, you know, all these things. And then if they have a system, and then the word of mouth gets going, and then their friends have a system and all that. I mean, these are not obvious things that really probably do have a very significant effect at a certain end of the video game market.
And the other thing is, I feel like, you know, the way that games are done these days and from the beginning is they tend to be very serialized. You set up, you know, you just try to establish a franchise, you release sequel after sequel, even more than in movies or books or any other kind of medium. There's an expectation that a successful game will reap successors.
10 sequels, a spinoff, and
a card
DLC.
Game.
To take this back to Uncharted, which we were talking about earlier. Uncharted came out 2 years ago. I did not have the system to play it on back then. Now that I do, I want to rent Uncharted, see if I like it. If I do, I'll probably go out and buy the sequel for $60 brand new.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so again, these are the kinds of spin-off effects of having something like a used game market or rental thing that you know, maybe the companies can't really fully factor in because it's more intangible. Is it killing the industry? I really don't think so. In terms of where does it come out on the positive, negative scale overall, that's really difficult to say.
See, I think it's time to bust out some knowledge here. Now, if you all recall, the game rental has already kind of been fought, where the Nintendo lawsuit versus, I can't remember who they sued.
Sure. Well, it's illegal in Japan, and that's why Nintendo filed that suit, is they were a Japanese company, even more so back then, in the 80s. And they said, well, if we can't do it in the homeland, they shouldn't be able to do it here.
No.
And they were like, no, this is America, bitch.
But I've never bought a used Wii game. It's never happened. I've bought used DS games. They're usually throwaway purchases. But more or less, I've never bought a used DS game. I have exclusively bought used 360 games, and it's not some moral decision, it's because 360 games cost more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's part of it too.
Like, I will never pay $60 for a game.
Oh, and this seems to be a pretty well institutionalized pricing dynamic there, where it's like, comes out high, sells what it's going to sell, then it goes into the low.
On 360 games, that's the case, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. It's a different environment to the Wii and the DS.
It's very weird. You know, like I said, I've never bought a 360 game that's newer than 6 months, but in 6 months, I'll get the game for $15 used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I could have rented Klonoa on Wii, and I could have easily beaten it in a rental period and with it in less than a week and sent it back, and I never would have missed it, you know, but it's $30.
Yeah.
I'm happy to spend
that. Or in the case of what I think I saw today, is Spyborgs really that cheap?
I've heard that it's already hit 20.
Yeah, somewhere. That's what I saw today in the store.
That is rapid fire, isn't it?
That is bombatonic. Yeah. I mean, that's been out less than a month.
It because I was like, no way. Cannot be $20.
That is insane. Oh my god. For new copies?
It was new. I sat there and looked at it and I'm like, this can't be the used copy already.
That is
it?
Shocking. That is get this shit off my shelf before it poisons everything around it.
Did you buy Spyborgs or did you just play?
No, I still have the review copy of it.
It's a review copy. When did you get it?
2 weeks ago, probably.
2 weeks ago, and I could go buy it for $20 new.
This is why, you know, we don't deal with prices in our reviews, because by the time they get written, they may well have changed quite a lot.
By the time our reviews get written, they're guaranteed to have changed.
Well, I mean, like the thing is, the big problem I have with used games is that everybody, I mean, you have this, you know, you have a faction that's kind of railing against used games, but I have yet to really see an alternative to it.
New games, John. That's your alternative to used games.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I have yet to really see somebody actually solve that problem and kind of propose something that actually solves the problem that used games are solving.
I don't really see what the problem is in the first place.
That games that cost $60 is really expensive.
Well, I think the answer to it is real price diversity.
As opposed to every game comes out at $60.
Yeah, we're seeing more of that this generation than ever, and part of it is because of the backlash against $60 games, which I think was a bad idea from the start. But I mean, if you can't make a profit selling your game at $50, maybe you should rethink your production strategy. Maybe you should have a more efficient process here.
You're starting to sound like a Nintendo executive, Johnny. Well, if your game costs $60 per unit to make, you could have made it cheaper.
But obviously it doesn't.
Yes, but I mean, that's why we still get $50 games on the Wii, though. Except for that odd multi-platform title where they think they can get away with it.
Yeah, I think Guitar Hero, or Beatles Rock Band is $60 on Wii.
Well, there's a few that go the other way, like Excitebots at $40, but yeah. I mean, it's true.
Or just Spyborgs at $20.
Well, that was not intentional.
You know, Klonoa was $30. I remember buying Katamari Damacy for $20 on the day it came out for PS2.
But it's true. I mean, there is an unusual amount when you think of the diversity of productions that there are in the video game industry, or even that there could be more so. You know, the price stickiness, these very predefined sets of prices that you have to adhere to, it kind of seems unreasonable. Mm-hmm. Really, it just seems too inflexible.
And that's why used games...
Yeah, they kind of, they provide flexibility where there hasn't been. So I guess you might say that the substitute would be sort of a more liberalized, sort of reformed new game market.
Yeah, and we're headed in that direction. And honestly, I mean, digital distribution feeds into that, because it's much easier to change the price. It's much easier to sell something for what it actually should cost in the first place.
Fewer people taking the cut for us at all.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Fewer middlemen.
Cuts out distributors if there is a distributor. Cuts out the retailer.
Well, and it cuts out all the manufacturing costs and everything else. So.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cost it cuts out, but...
A lot, yeah. You wouldn't know it from Sony, but
that doesn't really benefit the consumer as much as it benefits the company that's
it benefits the consumer if they're selling Shadow Complex for $15 instead of $60. That's when it fucking benefits the consumer.
It depends
a lot
on what they do with the price. I wouldn't be surprised if whenever we make the jump to full digital distribution, they don't cut the prices. I would be completely unsurprised if that happens.
Well, if they don't, then people won't buy them because you can't buy those games used anymore.
I don't foresee a complete literally dumping physical media entirely for quite some time.
Yeah.
I think you'll continue to see parallel strategies, sort of like the PSP Go, but perhaps better executed and more rational. But,
I would hope so.
They'll always be, for, not always, but there will be for a long time a sort of, you know, a model where there'll be a certain amount of physical media stuff going on, especially in the markets that Nintendo are looking at, because, you know, that's probably going to be a lot slower to kind of embrace not having physical copies of things. So
that will take
a long time, and it will be a gradual drift from one side to the other rather than a tipping point. Although I'm sure at some point it would become uneconomic to continue to produce things if there really is very little market left for it.
Well, we're going to move on, and I think we're going to just do one more letter this week, because we're going to have to wrap this up pretty soon. And James has the next letter.
Chris in Minneapolis writes, "Hi guys, I've been listening to your podcast since the new cast started in January of last year, which happened to coincide exactly with me buying a Wii, and I love your show. It's very funny and entertaining. I recently bought a PS2 because I missed playing EA's hockey series, which was not available on Wii." And he parenthetically notes, "I know they didn't do a PSD version this year either, but last year's version is fine with me. Do you think if Nintendo was to make the new Classic Controller Pro more mainstream in their system, they would be able to get series like EA's Hockey back to Nintendo? There are many games which work better with the Wiimote and Nunchuck, but others where I would prefer a more traditional control method."
Yeah, Nintendo's in a kind of a tough spot with Classic Controller and Classic Controller Pro, because it's like they want it to be there as an olive branch to certain gamers, but at the same time they can't really push it as a major component of their system, because it undermines everything else that they've worked so hard to achieve with Wii, which is the accessibility and the uniqueness and the new innovative new horizons of what video games can even be defined as. And all of a sudden you stick this thing on there that looks very much like a PlayStation 3 controller, especially with the Pro. And all of a sudden you're really kind of just erasing all the progress that you've made.
Oh, I agree with that. I mean,
it's tricky.
I think that the most likely thing that you would do in terms of trying to popularize it to some extent, it would probably be limited, is looking at the Japanese example with Monster Hunter 3, you know, in terms of bundling it with a specific piece of software that obviously it would be preferable to use it for. And then that piece of software would be sufficiently sort of have some sort of self-contained fan base like Monster Hunter, and then by the adoption of that game by those people, maybe publishers could start to say, actually, you know, people who own Wii, there are quite a few of them that have got this controller, so maybe we could think about it. But that's really quite limited. I mean, I guess the biggest opportunity would have been if you pushed the Classic controller alongside Super Smash Bros. Brawl. But they didn't do that. It was just kind of assumed, well, you know, you've probably got GameCube controllers, or you've probably got Classic controllers, or, you know, you'll deal with the Wii Remote and Nunchuck version of the controls or whatever. It was just left to you to deal with that. They didn't push anything.
The reason why EA dropped a lot of these sports games from Nintendo platforms is because they weren't selling, too. I don't think EA is particularly concerned about controllers, because they've shown in the past a willingness to try to work with the Wii controller for their family play, and then whatever they used to call it.
Mm-hmm.
All play.
I think it's more an issue of they just don't think there's a market for these games on the Wii.
Well, hockey is, that's the thing. I mean, like, their hockey games are kind of, they're more niche than Madden, for sure.
Yeah, like they're only one step above NCAA baseball.
Yeah.
That is the most niche EA sports game they make for the US.
Let's see, even Madden hasn't done absolutely brilliantly on the Wii by any stretch of the imagination. Tiger's done well, but there's obvious reasons for that, you know, because the controller is really very beneficial to that. So I think, yeah, I mean, that's probably more of a motivating factor in that particular case.
I mean, they did try NCAA football on the Wii for
a year.
Yeah,
that was another. You know, was that because the control scheme, you know, they weren't happy with? Well, not really, because they're still putting out motion control Maddens. I mean,
yeah,
you know,
it just didn't sell. That was the reason.
It was not a success at all.
That's the thing. I mean, and while I can understand that to a certain extent, you know, whatever, you know, hockey is more of a niche sport. Still, though,
I do love me some hockey.
They have made some, like EA has made some of the best. When I think back to the 16-bit days, some of the 16-bit hockey games that they made, especially for Sega, were absolutely amazing. And why they aren't bringing stuff like that to WiiWare just for play with the Classic controller, I have no answer for.
You don't need to have a particularly complicated game to really capture what hockey is.
Well, I mean, even with football, they have Madden NFL Arcade coming out. So why can't they do the same thing for hockey?
Well, I think you could more fully capture without dumbing down the sport of hockey in a simplistic title.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think hockey as a sport is. I enjoy hockey, so don't take it the wrong way. It's kind of arcadey. I mean, it really
it's
is.
It's not super strategic.
It is and compared it isn't, but I mean...
Compared to something like football.
You can, yeah, you know, can make... It's a relatively simple
game. It's
more
about game. Finesse.
I mean, you could...
It's more fluid than football.
Yeah.
You could
do the same with soccer or football, if you want, depending on how you
yeah,
say
it. Yeah, and plenty of people have done...
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't need to be super strategically detailed.
An interesting case, actually, is that, you know, I mean, even with Pro Evo on Wii, which has the complicated IR-based...
As that sport gets, yeah.
That very complicated scheme, they have implemented classic controller support now as well. So, I mean, people are, you know, people do support the classic controller in quite a number of cases, just because the classic controller is not something that's ever been really explicitly pushed or, you know, paired up with a marquee title or anything. The developers do still are still aware of its existence and still, you know, do a certain amount of things around it.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't think it's that dire a situation in that case, and as James said, I think it's just about the commercial viability of some of those EA Sports games on Wii that kind of goes.
Yeah, I mean,
those.
I would love to get a good hockey game on Wii.
Well,
I don't
think that EA's made the best effort on Wii either.
No, they haven't. But I'm not sure exactly what would be a viable, like how detailed they would have to make it for it to be a viable game. Could they?
I was happy with Wayne Gretzky's 3D hockey for N64. That's the last one I played.
I would be happy with an updated version of Sega.
Blades of Steel.
No, I would be happy with an updated version of NHL 94 or 95. I forget which one was the Uber one.
You start talking numbers like that, man, and I phase out.
Well, it's just you know, that there was that heyday of EA Sports. You know, it was the beginning of EA's rise to, you know, the dominance of when they put. But it was mostly on the Genesis. You know, PGA Tour, and obviously Madden, and the hockey game, and FIFA. Of course, soccer in Europe and everything. They won after another. Each sport was, you know, and they were all really well received. I think I rented one of those hockey games. It was pretty good.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah,
they're really good.
I
played the hell out of those games back in the day at my friend's house.
Well, they were fun. They were very arcadey, but they had, you know, enough of a kind of sim element to them that they had all the real players.
It's
and everything,
not like
so.
The league doesn't need money. I mean, for God's sake, they've got to handle the bankrupt Coyotes situation.
Oh
right
God,
now.
Don't even get
They'll
me started on
money.
That. I hate you, Gary Bettman. I fucking hate you. But please
so
continue.
I think when it comes to more niche sports like hockey, you know, college football, college baseball, like James said, even stuff like rugby and, you know, all kinds of stuff. There's a cricket game for PS2.
There's a cricket game for Wii as well. Got pushed pretty hard over here during the Ashes.
I think what it comes down to is companies like EA are looking at these sports and they're looking at the demographics for the different platforms. And I think what they're seeing is that on Wii, most of the user base are either younger people or older people. And the people who are most interested in playing sports video games are college age and 30-something guys.
Especially NCAA football.
And they are far more likely to own the other systems. And that's why it works out that way. The reason Tiger sells the most on Wii is not because of the controller. It's because golf is an old man's game. Sorry.
The demographics. I think probably there might be. Yeah,
it's a combination.
Plus, I mean, yeah, it's definitely a combination.
It's a combination.
Because
Tiger was selling great on there before Motion Plus came out.
It was mostly because of the demographics. I think some people who are sort of quite serious Tiger players, who would say, you know, I want to get the Wii version because the controls really are that much better now. How significant those numbers are in the commercial sense, you know, who knows?
Yeah,
it's mostly a mainstream game. And when you look at Madden, the reason that EA continues to make Madden for Wii, even though it's not selling that great, is because, and this is my own little theory here, but, you know, Madden sales on PS3 and Xbox have been going down. They're declining year on year, and it's still a big seller, but it's not as big as EA would like, and they're paying big bucks for that exclusive license to the NFL. So they've got to sell a lot of copies of Madden, and they're getting into the danger zone in terms of that series. It seems like people are losing interest in the series. I think what they're doing on Wii is trying to sell Madden to groups of people who've never bought a Madden game before. And I think that's what they're going for. And they
you'd be silly not to try and grasp that opportunity that Wii presents. Right. You know, it's this gateway, a sort of conduit to new users that you didn't have before because they might just not have a console at all.
Exactly.
But still,
that's who they're going after.
Closing the deal with them seems to be quite difficult, but I don't know what the production costs are, but they still may be making their money back pretty comfortably in terms of just the Wii part of it.
Yeah, well, right. I mean, they're trying to hit the jackpot on Wii. They're trying to find the formula for it, so.
But I mean, the other part of it, I guess, is that, you know, in terms of this classic controller support issue in general, you know, there's not that many games that would be built around, you know, a classic, a traditional controller interface, you know, that are going to be on Wii because, you know, it begs the question, well, why wouldn't it be on something else?
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a real, you know, there's only going to be so many games that this is going to apply to.
And the valid answers to that question are, well, it's either a first-party game, and we've seen Nintendo doesn't have a whole lot of interest in making stuff that would be mapped
and in
to
fact,
the
a lot of
controller.
Their traditionally controlling first-party games, they say, you know what, if we want it to be mainstream, we don't want people to have to use something that's an additional accessory. So, you know, New Super Mario Bros. Wii could use a classic controller, but it doesn't because it just goes for NES style. Wario Land Shake It, same thing.
Punch out,
exactly. And then on the other hand, you've got maybe stuff like Muramasa's just a case of, well, you know, they probably didn't have the development budget to do it for the HD console.
Yeah, it's so because it's Japanese and they're going for the, you know, they're going for the large install base and they're trying to keep production costs down, and that's why it's on the Wii. And they don't care about motion control, so they're happy to support classic.
Yeah, so what? But the point is that that's the kind of space you're talking about. That's not a big space,
right?
You know? So clearly, it's just not something that's ever going to reach some big critical mass. But on the plus side, it's developers don't pretend it doesn't exist.
It's been fairly well supported from the start.
Yeah, exactly. So I wouldn't say I've been disappointed with Wii games in that regard.
All right, well, that's going to wrap up the show for this week. Before we go, I do want to remind you to please go vote in the retroactive poll for the Genesis game that we'll be playing next within a couple of weeks. And that poll, it's kind of on a short time schedule a little bit, but you will have a few days to vote on it after this podcast goes up, so I hope you'll go and check that out and look at it. There's some somewhat obscure games, I guess. There's no Sonic the Hedgehog on there. I want it to be something that would be new to most of us and maybe would be something that hasn't been talked about to death already. So it's going to be pretty interesting, whatever comes out on top there, and I hope you'll go vote, and of course I hope you'll play along with whatever wins, and we'll be announcing the winner of that poll on the next episode. So with that, I think we're done, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Later.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Don't you think Graw sounds like something you'd eat with biscuits?
Johnny is super focused on this game.
It sounds like something I do when I'm feeling really good. No.
John's doing his Bowser impression.
Like I can take on the world kind of thing, you know? Like I'm super psyched.
It makes me think of Guar also.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. I just think Guar sounds like something that should be said in like a deep southern accent. Guar. Mm-hmm. Guar.
Oh.
This is officially called pissing all over your choice of games. Mm-hmm.
You do realize that at this point, any game you pick from here on out is fair game for me to say whatever the fuck I want about
yeah,
it, right?
Yeah, because we've always had the reins on you, James.
Yeah, you've demonstrated such restraint in the past.
In the past, I have sometimes thought, I'll let that go.
Give me an example.
No more.
Go on, substantiate your claim.
I don't have to substantiate them now. When I don't do it is when you'll see that I'm serious. One of my squad members decides, I can shoot this thing down, steps out from behind his barricade, and is immediately gunned down like the dumbass he is, and then starts screaming, I'm hit! And so I tell the medic to go get him. The medic gets gunned down. I'm like, oh, this is just a fuckload of shit. So I basically shot down a helicopter with a handgun. This is the kind of game
you shot a helicopter with a handgun.
A lot of shots. It was
and
like
people said the bit in Private Ryan where Hanks was trying to shoot the tank with the handgun was silly.
I think a helicopter is much more reasonable to shoot down with a gun. I'm envious that Johnny has time to do things after he records this podcast, I have to say.
Well, it's earlier for me. It's 2 hours earlier.
I've got plenty of time to do stuff after this. It's just the day's just starting.
A whole new world. Yeah.
Yes, I have time to sing Disney songs. And now, the finale to Ernest Goes to Jail, as told by Jonathan Metz.
He's trying to prevent his alter ego, identical evil twin guy from robbing the bank where Ernest was working before he, you know, unwittingly switched places with this criminal. And Ernest is trying to defend the bank and thwart the robbery, and he gets shocked again by an anti-theft device that the bumbling security guards tried to install. And this time, instead of shooting electricity out of his hands and everything like he did when he was in the electric chair, he actually gains the ability, he becomes magnetic, and he gains the ability to float, which as a child I thought was awesome, as you might expect. And so he floats around the bank and saves the day. Wah, 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 wah.